We left off on Daf Ayin Hey Amud Aleph. We have one section to do, which is really a little bit on the, I would say, tedious side. It's how different kelim are kashered. It's very rare that I actually turn my attention and pull out a copy of the old Sansino, because I need the translations, because there are many words that I'm simply not familiar with. So even sometimes I find after reading the Sansino translation, I still don't know what the words mean. I don't know what the English words mean, but okay. So anyway, we were on the ninth line, on Daf Ayin Hey Amud Aleph, the words, Ba'u Minei Me Rabbi Abahu. They asked Rabbi Abahu the following question. Hani Gurage Da Aramai, Mai. Okay, that's, so Aramai, that's easy. It means the non-Jews. It refers to some part of the wine of the vat. And in this case, Rashi explains, he quotes different explanations, but it's not clear that they're actually any different, is that you had piled up the grapes, they got pressed, but you don't want the grapes to kind of fall out, so they build like this little netting around. They call it, I think he translates, a wicker. Rashi describes it after you get past the French. It's the last medium line in Rashi, Guragi Akalim, he says, V'korchim osam sevivos hatapuach, Shelo yispasru ha'anavim mikovet hakora. So you basically put them around the tapuach. It's not an apple, but it means tapuach is a term when you have stuff piled up in a heap. I guess it looks a little bit like an apple. You have a tapuach on the mizbeach of ashes. They describe as tapuach, and this is described as tapuach. You have all this, you know, pressed grapes, but you want to now lower the beam and really squeeze them out. But of course, the grapes want to get out of the way, so they're going to go flying. So you put this netting around it to prevent it from escaping. So the question is, if a Gentile pressed wine and in his press, how do you kasher this? So Amar Rabbi Abahu. Rabbi Abahu said, we have a braisa, tenisuha. Hareisha hayu gitav ubeis badav tameim. So this is actually not about kashering per se. It's about tuma vitara. The assumption, and the issue is the following, that in order to be mitaher, when you put stuff, when you want to be mitaher something, so the rule is, you can be mitaher most kelim, most vessels. A human being can go to the mikvah, but you cannot be mitaher ochlim or mashkim or klecheres. I'm pretty sure we spoke about this, about mashkim, the one exception where you can make it tahor when it became tameh, but you can't do tvila on it, is water. Water you can make tahor by the process of hashaka, by attaching it to the mikvah, becomes part of the mikvah, and then it becomes tahor. But basically everything, every other liquid and foods, once they become tameh, as long as they're still edible, as soon as they're all consumable, so they retain their tumah. And the klecheres retains its tumah as long as it's usable. The way you get rid of tumah from a klecheres is you smash it. Okay, so So here, but in principle, the assumption would be is that you have to get all the wine out of these things, or enough of the wine out of these kelim, that there's really no more wine there, and now you want to be metayer the kli. The kli you can probably put in the mikvah. And if the kli is the kind of kli that's not makabel tumah, then there's no wine that's left, because if there's wine that's left, and you press new wine, the old wine that's tameh is going to make the new wine tahar. So the assumption of the Gemara, and we'll state it explicitly, is that the same mode that's required for kashering is the mode that's required for kashering is the same as the mode that's required for making it tahor, for basically removing the wine, so now you can, either the kelim are tahor, or you can dip them, now the kelim in the mikvah, make them tahor. So, hareisha hayu gitav ubeis badav tamei. Magas is the wine press, the beis abad is the olive press. Ubikesh lasosam bitahara. So this is, let's say, an amaretz who wants to make, he wants to do a tahor run, it's like the kosher run. Hadapim v'ha'adashim v'halulavim madichon. So the dapim, Rashi says, are the flat boards that you place upon the tapuach itself, the pile of grapes. The adashim, I don't know if there's Rashi, he does explain. He says the adashim is actually the gas itself, which is presumably the kli that holds the grapes and ultimately the wine, at least temporarily accumulates in until it flows down into the bore, into the pit, where the final product sort of accumulates. And then lulavim are, Rashi says, the mops, the things that you sweep, the brooms that you sweep the grapes that fell aside. So all of these things are come in contact in some way with the grapes or wine. So all of these things, the braisa says madichan. It's sufficient simply to rinse them off, and then you're fine. V'akalim shel netzarim, and this Rashi says that this is what this is the same thing they asked Rabbi Abba about. This is the guragi. So the akalim, if you have these this wicker shel netzarim v'shel batzputz. So netzarim, Rashi says that there's some kind of twigs. That's not clear what they are. And batzputz, he says, is canvas. So they require menagvan. So we spoke about last week, what is niguv? Niguv means to use water and ashes to clean them. So they require more of a cleansing. Vishel shipa, vishel gemi. And then if it's made of these materials, I don't know what Rashi only gives you French words. As I may have once observed before, a chaver of mine once commented, tongue-in-cheek, that Rashi obviously learned Old French so he could put the words in his commentary. So here he describes if it is made of bast and reeds. Okay, I don't know what bast is, B-A-S-T is, but some type of material. So these things absorb more, and the only way to be mitar them, to get the wine out, is miyashnon yud beis chodesh. You have to allow them to dry for 12 months. Lead them on use for 12 months, and now we assume they are so totally dry, there's anything left of the wine is not considered wine, and there's no tumma associated with it. Then Rab Shimon Gamliel Omer no manichan me gas lagasa mi bad labad. You have to leave it from one wine press season to the next one, or one olive press season to the next one. And the Gemara immediately asks, "Hainu Tanakama, what's the difference? I mean, you generally the wine and the olives were pressed at one time during the year, or probably a short time, and presumably you would use them you would use it 12 months later. So the Gemara says, Ika beinai churfei va'afle. Sometimes you have an early season, sometimes you have a late season. So the Tanakama's opinion is that it's 12 months, no matter what, and Rav Shimon Leal's opinion is that basically it's enough from season to season. Now, so that was an interruption, in the Bryce itself. That one line in the Gemara from Hainu Tanakama to Churfei Va'afle is not part of the Bryce. The Gemara, you know, is like the Talmud couldn't wait to ask the question. It was too impatient. So, one sec, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, now they've kind of fixed it. Okay, let's go on. Rabbi Yose Omer, the last part of the Bryce, Harotza L'Taharon Miyad. Let's say you don't want to wait. Magilan Berotchen, you either do Hagalah with boiling water, o choltan b'mezesim, or, and I'm not really sure what the difference is, chalita means to put something in boiling water, but in this case, the water that was used for processing olives. I imagine that it has some type of more sharper properties, stronger properties of stuff that it must have absorbed from the olives, and therefore somehow that can then get things out. The term chalita, we have, I'm sure, discussed at one point in the past, usually means to throw something into boiling water. It's most famous. It comes up in a few places. It comes up sometimes in Shulchan Aruch in the context of if you were to take a piece of meat and cast it into boiling water, you basically seal it. It is a little like searing, and it would seal the blood inside, which is fine as long as the blood doesn't come out and go back in. You know, regular, normal, like, must say, muscle blood. As an aside, there's no issur in consuming unsalted meat. It's only a problem of cooking unsalted meat. When you cook, the halacha is that the dam that's found inside, let's say, regular meat, not inside organs, like inside the heart, but dam found inside regular, let's say, muscle meat, so it's mutter to consume. It's only if it comes out that it becomes asur. And the problem is that when you cook it in a pot, in the cooking process, the blood comes out and the blood goes back in, which is why unsalted meat certainly can be roasted on a fire, because any blood that comes out is assumed to drip down, and if there's anything left inside, it's not actually a problem. So if you had a piece of raw meat and you like eating raw meat, as long as you rinse it off from any blood on the surface, so then it's permissible to consume that meat. So anyway, one of the ways of getting around the salting issue is if you do chalita. Sometimes they talk about doing it in vinegar. It also, unfortunately, much to my chagrin, comes up for Pesach purposes. We have a chumra of the Gaonim. If it weren't for the fact that the Gaonim forbade chalita, there are two ways of stopping a dough from leavening. One way is to bake it, and the other way is to throw it into boiling water. When you throw it into boiling water, we call that pasta. So if it weren't for the chumrah of chalit of the Gaonim, then theoretically, if you made very carefully, you made your dough, there's no yeast in pasta dough, and you cut it up, you extrude it through the shapes, threw it into boiling water within your 18 minutes, and you can have pasta on Pesach. But unfortunately, we can't, because the Gaonim will machmir, we're not experts in chalita, and therefore maybe you won't do it right. So anyway, that's chalita. So either Yosef basically says if you can't afford to wait, you can use some kind of hot extraction of the wine. Okay, and then Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel Mishum Rabbi Yose Omer, a different approach. No, manichan tachas tzinor shemeimav mekalchan. You can put it either under a downspout where the water is constantly flowing, o b'mayon shemeimav rodfim, or in a spring where it's not still, but the waters are rodfim, means flowing very quickly. Vikama, but how long do you have to leave them there? The answer is ona. You have to leave them there, and the Gemara will talk about what an ona is in a second, but it means 24 hours. Well, they'll describe it, they'll talk about it in a second. And then the Braisa concludes, Hederach she'amru b'yayinesech, kach amru b'tara. So the Braisa concludes that just as they said this b'yayinesech, the same rule applies to tumah v'tara. Now, immediately the Gemara says, and you might realize there's a problem with that line, klape laya, everything, that's, it's an idiom, I don't know what exactly the words mean, klape laya means everything's out of order. The Braisa was talking about tumah v'tara. What the Braisa should have said at the end was, just as these things apply by Tumah V'Tara, they apply to Yai Nesach as well. So that's the Gemara. Klape Laya, B'Taros Kaminan. The Braisa is talking about Tumah V'Tara. Ella, now they modify the line of the Braisa, K'derech She'amru B'Taros, Kach Amru B'Yai Nesach. Okay, so that's the conclusion. So the answer to the question, Rabbi Abahu's question, the question posed to Rabbi Abahu, of how do you kasher the wicker that holds the grapes in? The answer was, depending upon the material, you either have to use the afer, the ashes in the water, or you have, in certain cases, because it's far more absorbent, you have to let it basically be unused dry for 12 months. Okay.
Quick question. Yeah. The 12 months, is that based on some of the aroma phenomenon? Looking at it after 12 months, or is it just a be'erech, or
I see that conceptually the same thing as the 24 hours of kavush kemavushal, right? They pick a time period that seems to them really covers most bases. It's not so different, by the way, than shishim. The way the Gemara describes the shear of shishim, so that Iser will be batel when it falls into Heter. The way the Gemara describes that is that the Chachamim looked at all the Iserim that exist and discovered that. It wasn't actually b'shishim, they gave a different way, kibbutzel b'kaplot, but basically they saw that basically no matter how strong the isser was in flavor of the typical isserim, it would be batel in that amount, and that was the number they gave. Clearly there are things that do not require shishim, that's why in theory, not for Ashkenazim, for Sfardim, they still have the institution, I don't know if they still use it, of asking a guy to taste it, because sometimes it'll be, you don't need shishim. But they gave us basically a rule of thumb, and that rule of thumb, you know, contains, that's the safe margin. Are there things that after 24 hours might still not have absorbed, you know, in kavush, in being pickled? The answer is, yeah, but 24 hours, you know, that's what we assume for most things, except for exceptional things. Okay. So now the Gemara says, Kama ona, okay, how much is an ona? Amar b'chia bar abba, amar b'yochanan. Oh, I'm sorry, oyom o laila, so it's 12 hours. Rabbi Chana, she'ina, v'r amri la Rabbi Chana bar she'ina, Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, chatzi yom v'chatzi laila. Half a day and half a night. Now you say, well, that's kind of the same thing. So the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzchak v'lo pligi, habit kufas nisan v'tishrei, habit kufas tamos v'teves. It depends what time of year you're talking about. I mean, the truth is, it's only true, o yom o laila is only technically true at the equinox. It's not true, and in fact, it's actually not true at the equinox. For those of you who have, if you ever look at the time charts, the equinox in March and in September, it's not a 12-hour day, 12-hour night. The day is actually longer. I think it's because the sun's rays are bent by the horizon, so daylight at the equinox is actually, like 6 or 8 minutes longer than the night. So if you actually want a 12-hour day, 12-hour night, you got to go a little earlier in March, and you got to go a little later in September. But the point is, working approximately at the time of what we would call Tkufas Nisan, Tkufas Tishrei, which are the equinoxes, so then you can say, you could have said Chatzi Yom, Chatzi Laila, or you could have said O Yom, O Laila, but when you go to Tkufas Tkefes, Teves, and Tkufas Tamas, which are the solstices, so there, obviously, the day and the night are quite lopsided, and therefore we give the shear of Chatzi Yom, the Chatzi Laila, and that will certainly be accurate within half a minute or something like that, of getting us 12 hours. Okay. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, so we have more Kalim to come, I'm sorry. Hani Ravake da Aramai. Ravake are filters. They would filter the wine, or they would take the dregs that have wine absorbed, they put them in the filter so that the liquid could drip through and you'd have pure wine. So how do you kasher those? So the Gemara says, Demazia, if they're made out of hair, madihan. It's enough to rinse them off. Now, it is kind of interesting. Rashi says the hair of people, and it is true that human hair is not really absorbent. At least, I believe it's true, and it's true halachically. It comes up in Hilchos Shabbos that the ein schita beseir. Technically speaking, and midoraisa for sure, wringing out hair is not considered schita because the water is not absorbed within the fibers of the hair. It's really just between individual hairs. Now, I know in reality that might... Marshall's looking at me puzzled. That might be true in every material that you have that's absorbent. It's between the fibers. It's not in the space of the fibers, but hairs are probably more easily distinguishable than you can in the fibers in some type of a cloth, and that's why, I assume that's why they say in schita beseir.
Hair adsorbs, so it can attach around the hair, but cannot go into it.
Okay.
So it's actually the perfect thing for picking up oil spills. So if you take hair and you soak it in oil, it'll adhere to the hair.
But not doesn't get absorbed. Yeah. Okay.
Hence, you can wash your hair on the other.
That's a separate. And my answer to that question is you have to ask the local Orthodox rabbi. But the truth is the Shulchan Aruch, everybody would permit washing the hands, feet, and face. I assume it includes the head. Yes, but the answer is those who tell people to shower, we tell midrabanan there's an iser shechita, but it's not a problem washing your hair. We just tell people don't. For men, it's usually unless they have a lot of hair. It's more relevant for women. Again, there are men who have a lot of hair. There are women who don't have a lot of hair. But typically speaking, if you have long hair, you're told not to wring it out. But it's not. It's only shechita midrabanan. So Gemara talks about it in the context of needing to bring shemen, to bring oil through Rosh Hasharabim for a choles. They talk about putting it besara. And they say, at least midaraisa ain't shechita beseir. So, and I didn't realize, but now you've taught me, apparently hair is very good for transporting oil. So that's interesting. Okay, fine. Yes, Isaac.
I was just looking at yesterday. Rav Avadya Yosef talks about having hanah from the hair of somebody who's deceased.
Yes.
And a big dispute. And
did this come up for the Chevra Kadisha?
Yeah. Because it just came out. It was printed in 2010, a three-volume set of...
No, I know, but is it Lamaisa for the Chevra Kadisha?
Well, Lamaisa, it's not Lamaisa because we wash the hair. But
Right. But nobody's
saying,
cutting the hair at that point.
He's saying you could have Hanah, and he brings down... So yesterday afternoon...
It's a machlokas harishonim.
No, but he brings down because it doesn't absorb any liquids.
What does that have to do with getting Hanah?
So I'm not sure, but I'll
there is, next week. There's a sugya in Daf Test that talks about Seir Shomais and whether it's mutter or not. And whether it's permissible to get Hanah from it.
It's not part of the goof. It's not part of the goof because it doesn't absorb.
So one day in Rishonim is that it's referring to Peah Nachra, so Shetel, that Mace was wearing when presumably she died. And the other, but the Rambam, I think, reads the Maskan of the Sugya that hair of the Mace is not Asur B'Hanah. But I maybe it's a Machlokas Sfaradim Ashkenazim. Yeah, because it's considered separate. It's considered separate, even though it's attached when the Mace dies. So, but I don't know why that would affect the question of why. I assume we're not trimming. No, actually, nobody is trimming the hair off of the deceased. What? According to the Rambam, you know, there are things that might technically be mutter that somehow we understand are just unseemly. So, correct. Okay.
Theoretically.
So filters of hair you just need to rinse off. The amra is tzemer. That's the Aramaic word for tzemer. The ayin and the tzadi switch, like eretz in Hebrew is ar'a in Aramaic. So the amra, made of wool, so menagvan, that requires nigov, which is more of a process. And the kisna in Aramaic is pishtan, is flax, so that is miyashnan. But the i'ika katre, if there are kisharim, if there are knots in this thing, shari lehu, you have to untie them. Okay. Now the Gemara continues with more. Hani dakule v'chalasa da'aramai. So dakule are presumably something from a palm tree. And chalasa, Rashi says, is a kaveres shel shvatim. A kaveres is like a hive. Sometimes it is the word for beehive, kaveres shel dvorim, but it's like a little bit wicker-like, and it's some type of a strainer. Rashi says, misanin ibahem yayin, you strain the wine in it. So hani dakule v'chalsa daramoi, non-Jews' materials that have been used, dechaite, and chaite means to be sewn or somewhere. Chayit is a tailor. So bechavle detsure, that are tied, that are sewn with some type of ropes made of, Rashi says, of palm strands. So madichan, it's enough to rinse them. Ditzvasa, some type of a, Rashi says, min gemi, I assume it's some type of a grass. So then, linagvan, you have to use the detergent. And finally, the kisana, miyashdan. And if it's flax, then you have to leave it unused for 12 months. Same thing. V'ispahu kitre, same rule. If there are knots in it, sharilu, you have to permit it. Okay, so that's the end of those kelim. And now the sugya concludes, and I haven't really figured out what it's doing here. One last halacha that relates to a vat of grapes, that grapes have been pressed in, but it has to do with tumah mitara, and whether if you touch one part, everything there is tameh, or whether each part can be regarded as a separate thing. Now, as a general rule, when you have a pool of liquid, if you touch one part of the liquid, everything, it's all connected, it's tameh. If you're dealing with solids that are separate pieces, for example, if you have, in this case, you're going to have clusters of grapes, if you touch one cluster of grapes, let's say you touch one piece of wood, so that entire piece of wood will be tame. Maybe the grapes are also considered part of it, but if it's not attached to the next one, then the next one is not going to be tame. Or tuma will descend a level up to the point where if the tuma level is too low to go, meaning a person can only go as low as a rishon. If you're a rishon l'tuma and you touch me, I'm tahar. If you're a rishon l'tuma, and you touch food, the food will become a sheni of the tumah. But if you're dealing with not things that are chulin, not truma, not kachim, and you have food which is a sheni of the tumah, and it touches another food, let's leave out liquid for the moment, that's a little more complicated, then that other food will not become tameh, because regular food cannot become a shlishi l'tumah. It can only descend as low as a sheni l'tumah. So basically, with that backdrop, itmar, am ha'aretz shehoshit yado legas. We are dealing with, when you talk about making a gas tahor, not from Yayin Nesach, not from a non-Jew's avat, but rather a Jew's, what we saw in the Braisa, you want to make it tahor, that means the Jew was probably an Amoretz, and he normally doesn't care about Tumah Batara, but now he wants to have the kosher run. So in this case, the Amoretz is hanging around, and oops, when he touches things, they become tamesh. Amoretz shehoshet yado legas, v'naga be'eshkolos, he touched the clusters. Rabbi v'Rabbi Chia, charamar eshkol v'chol sevivosav tameim. One of them said that eshkol and everything directly around it are tameim. And I assume Rishonim don't really comment. Rashi has very little to say about this. The Rambam quotes this halacha, has very little to say about it. I assume it means that whatever you are, if you touch, let's say, an eshkol, and that eshkol becomes a rishon l'tumah, let's say, and then sevivosav, anything that's touching that eshkol becomes a sheni l'tumah, and that's it. The rest of the gas are tahorim. One says that, nope, the entire gas is tmeya. Presumably, he either thinks it's some kind of exera, or he's concerned that maybe there's enough liquid floating around that he probably touched the liquid too, or the eshkol touched the liquid, and liquids are much more susceptible to tumah. I don't want to go deal with all the details right now, but bottom line is that when you start touching the liquid, you're in trouble. So the Gemara now says, you're talking about, I think in this case, they ground up olives, and now you find a dead sheretz, one of the eight shratzim. Most of them are reptiles of some kind, like lizards, geckos, chameleons. There's a mouse in there also, that's obviously a mammal. Sheret shenimsa berechaim, it's found in the mill in which they grind the olives. Eino mitame elamako mago. It's only the place that it touches, like one touches one olive, and that's the only thing that becomes tame, you know, unless, again, sheretz is an avatoma, the first olive is a rishon l'tumah, the second olive will be a shein l'tumah, that will be the end. But, v'imhoya mashke mahalech, if there is already liquid that's moving, then it's touching the liquid, or we're concerned about that, and therefore hakol tameh. So the Gemara says, no, hasam lo mifsak velomidi hacha mafsaki eshkolos. So somehow, again, there's very little clarification to be shown, but somehow here, by the olives, there's really nothing that separates one pool of liquid from the other. It's all interconnected. Here, somehow, the eshkolos are dividing. Again, if wine pooled in the bottom, you'd have the same thing. It's not entirely clear to me what exactly the difference is. I assume it's a slight difference in the case. Maybe if you were more familiar with ancient wine presses versus ancient olive presses, you would be obvious why in one the liquid would serve as a connector and one it wouldn't. But, okay, that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Orule Rabbanan l'Rav Yirmiya, Amrile l'Breid Rav Yirmiya, Kedivrei Omer, the Chachamim instructed Paskin for either Rav Yirmiya or Rav Yirmiya's son, Kedivrei Omer Eshkol v'chol Sivos l'Tveim, v'chol Hagas Kulo Tahor. That's the end. So that's the way they paskin. They were paskin l'kula, that you're only worried about the eshkol that the Amorites touched and the stuff immediately around it. Okay, Marshall.
Why does Reb Chaim have only one yud?
For two reasons. One is that I wouldn't prove anything from any printed text of the Gemara. But two, I assume that the dual form normally only contains one yud. Rechayim is the millstones, and it probably, the ayim form, like yadayim raglayim, is the only thing that's left in rabbinic and biblical Hebrew of the dual form, right? And originally Hebrew had, as many languages once upon a time had, I think English also did, I don't think there are any remnants, in modern English, singular, plural, but dual also. I don't know why that is, but, you know, somehow there must be something instinctual in language that you should have one, two, and many.
It's like a collective noun.
What do you mean by that?
It encompasses
both singular and plural.
And plural in grammar.
Mm.
No, but
this is the Well, singular and plural?
Yeah.
We'll give an example. The pronoun they is now being used for gender people.
Let's scratch that from the record. Let's move on. Okay. But bottom line is that all that's left in the Hebrew are mostly body paired parts and masayim, alpayim, a few things occasionally find, but that ayim ending. Not in Mayim probably, but in Shamayim might be. It's typically it's a plural, but it's dual specifically. And Rechayim, I assume, is called Rechayim is because you have two stones that were ground against one another. So you expect one yud. They're all in biblical Hebrew. I think all those Raglayim, Yadayim, it's all one yud. Modern Hebrew, they're probably going to put two yuds.
What's the Shoresh of Rechayim? Rechem?
I don't know. It's a good question. No, I assume it's. I have absolutely no idea. I'm glad I'm teaching biblical Hebrew. The word Rechayim doesn't occur in the first 10 Prakim of Bereishis. I have not a clue. I'd have to check the biblical Hebrew dictionaries for it.
What's his name here? He's very good
at that. Israel. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what the singular is, but I'm guessing only because the form really looks like it's a dual form. So I'm gathering, and there are two parts in it. You know, two major parts that are, you know, one ground against the other. So I'm guessing that it's dual. But that would have one yud. Okay. Fine. But I would emphasize even more the first part. As an example, sometimes the Gemara quotes a pasuk, or a Medrash quotes a pasuk, and it's apparent that they didn't have the exact same spelling that we do. You had it in yesterday's parsha. Rashi says, "V'levneha pilag shim asher la'Avraham," and the Medrash says that Keturah was Hagar. There was only one pilagesh, and he said that's why it's written chaser yud. The only problem is the pilag shim in our svarim have the yud at the end. This is a famous question, and many of the Rishonim have noted this. The Rashba and the Ran just say, apparently, the Medrash had a different text than we did, not the end of the world. So that does occur in a lot of interesting cases. So that most of them are trivial in the sense that it's just it's a spelling issue. It's not really a different word. But one of the things I always tell my students is that when you read a Gemara and you see a Gemara doesn't quote the Pasuk the way it's found in our Tanakh, either with a word is different, or literally a word missing, or the spelling is different, don't prove anything from that, because the printers were sloppy, sometimes the scribes were sloppy, and the only time you can prove what the Gemara that the Gemara or the Medrash had a different text than we do, is if the comments of the Medrash indicate that it had a different text, right? V'le'a pilag shim, it's not because in the Medrash it's spelled pilag shim without a yud, it's because it says that pilag shim is without a yud because Keturah was Hagar. And there are a few other famous examples of that, but if it's just being cited in the Gemara and nothing is being inferred from it and no comment is made about the spelling, that doesn't mean anything. Okay, so that's why generally I wouldn't worry about that when you see an odd spelling. Okay, now we get to the last Mishnah in the Masechta. Okay, now we're not learning Mishnah, so we don't make a siyum on this. What we're doing for most of the next blot is a little bit of review. If you go back to the videotape or the audio tape many years ago, right before Pesach, we did the beginning of this. But I'm sure that I know I could use a chazara. Maybe some other people could use a chazara, and some people weren't here. So we'll treat it as Torah should always be every day ki yu chadashim einecha. It should be like it's new. Okay, that doesn't mean we're supposed to forget everything we learned, but nonetheless. All right, so the Mishnah says, "Halokech tle tashmish min ha'ovdei kochavim." If you buy kelim from a non-Jew, So the Mishnah says, a shadarko lahatbil yatbil, that which you would regularly do tefillah on, which applies a mikvah, you should do tefillah. Lahagil yagil, that which you normally would put in boiling water, you put in boiling water. And lalabin ba'ur, yalabin ba'ur, that which we normally put in fire, you would put in fire. Now, what this means, this is a very difficult expression. What the Mishnah really means is the way the Torah formulates it. The story of Kasher and Kalim comes from Parshas Matos. The Jewish people went to war with Midian to avenge the entrapment of Baal Peor. And they came back, and they had taken all the plunder, and they had all this kitchenware. And now the question is, what did they do with it? They wanted to use it. So Elazar HaKohen instructed them on the basis of God's command. This is the other. There are two Zos Chukas HaTorah. One is the Paraduma, and one is, strange enough, Tfilas Kelim HaGalas Kelim. Shot, by the way, in the word Chok, doesn't mean there's no reason for it. It means the decree. It may have a reason, and the reason here is somewhat obvious. So the Torah says, Elazar says to him the following, Achas ha-zahav es ha-kosef, es ha-nechoshes, es ha-barzel, es ha-bedil, es ha-ofares. He lists six metals, and then he says, Kol davar asher yavo va'esh, ta'avir va'esh v'taher. Anything that's normally used in fire, you shall pass through fire, v'toher, and it shall become pure. Ach b'mei nida yischata. But it shall be purified, yischata, in mei nida. And it's not clear what that word means. The pshat probably means Mei haza'a. The word nida there probably means sprinkling. And probably the pshat is that these kelim were assumed to be tmei, maybe tmei emes. They become in contact with a dead person, and you had to sprinkle waters of the paraduma. The term mei nida is used in the parish of paraduma to make them tahorim. Okay, Chazal will have a different drasha, we'll see in the Gemara. V'chol davar ashele yavova esh, but anything that's not used in fire, taviru v'amoyim. You shall pass through water. Now, what Chazal understand, and what the Halacha understands, is that when you use a vessel with food directly on the fire, without a liquid medium in between, then that absorbs or burns on much more, is much harder to get off, and requires libun. The Chazal's understanding, the Halacha's understanding of libun, is libun does not extract absorptions. Libun simply destroys absorptions wherever they are. That's libun. If you cook using a liquid medium, so then you only need to do hagala in water. As some Rishonim say, you could do hagala in almost any liquid, any kosher liquid, in order to extract the absorptions of that were absorbed through a hot water. The rule that we often cite over and over in the laws of hagalas kelim is kibolo kach polto. The way it absorbs is the way it will literally spit it out. The term for using fire to kasher is called libun. The term for using water is called hagala. Hagala is kind of an interesting word because they talk about this parsha of the kelim that were taken from Midian. They call it giulei klei Midian. They talk about the giul can mean something that's abominable. V'ga'ala nafshi eschem, the Torah says in the Tochacha. So hagala is apparently getting out the giulim. It's the extraction of giulei klei nachrim. Now, the second lines in the Mishnah, the second and third lines that we read make sense. Eshedarko lahagil probably means that if the non-Jew uses it in a manner with hot liquid, then you have to do hagala. Lalabein ba'or, if he normally makes it white in fire, meaning he uses it on the fire and it absorbs that way, then yalabein ba'or. The difficult one is eshedarko lahatbil yatbil. Had the Mishnah said a shadarko lahadiach yadiach, to rinse off, you would say it was things that he used without heat, and the way you take care of it is you rinse it off. But the Mishnah says a shadarko lahatbil yatbil. It sounds like it's talking about doing tevila, and in fact, it's not clear whether the Gemara really, from the Gemara, but Rashi certainly understands, the Gemara understands this, yes, this is tefillah. And this is the halacha, that when one buys a kli, a vessel from a non-Jew, regardless of its kosher or non-kosher status, if it is metal, the six kinds of metal mentioned in the Torah, and the Chazal added on glass, one is required to do tevilas kelim. One is required to immerse the kelim in the mikvah. The Ran here on the Rif quotes a comment from the Yerushalmi, which is that the purpose of the tefillah is that it's Ole mitumasan shogayim l'kdushashan shal Yisrael. And what I think this means, and I think we probably discussed this once before, is this an idea that when we eat food, it's not just eating, it's not simply milui hakeres, it's not just filling our stomachs. There's a notion of kedusha. We talk about the person's shulchan, when there's no Beis HaMikdash, a person's shulchan is like his mizbeach. That's what's mechaper, when he feeds poor people and so on. But eating food is an act of kedusha, and it's supposed to be governed by the rules of kedusha. And therefore, just as we have restrictions on what food we eat, and on how we prepare the food, we also have preparations for our kelim that are typically used in the processing of food, and the eating of the food, they also require a purification. So a kli, which was owned by a non-Jew, and is now purchased by the Jew, it has to be purchased. If you're borrowing a non-Jew's kli, you don't need to do tefillah on it, because the kli is not becoming yours. But when it becomes part of your kitchen, it becomes part of almost like your azara or your Beis HaMikdash, now, if you're going to use it, not if it's decorative, that kli requires immersion in a mikvah.
Did the kli and the Beis HaMikdash require tefillah?
You mean when they were first made?
Yeah.
They were presumably made by Jews. So if it's made by a Jew, then it's not an issue. In fact, one of the if you ask me, I suspect if you ask the rabbis, all the Marad Asras in the shul here, if you have a kli that's like electro, let's say you have an urn that might have an electronic piece. You couldn't do it with modern urns. The old urns, the ones that are just like regular metal, not the fancy Eurolux things. So the problem is that you don't want to immerse it because of the electrical element. You're afraid something will happen and will damage it. So we would tell you probably, I know Schechter would say this, you just don't need to do tefillah. It's a mitzvah, but you can't do it. It's a mitzvah saseh, so you don't do it. That's all. It's not that it's also to use the kli. But Ramosha's Eitza with the urn was to take it to a craftsman, it probably doesn't matter Jewish or non-Jewish in this context, there's a long discussion in Shulchan Aruch about this, and to have him drill a hole in the metal, near the bottom, to render it unusable, and then to patch it. And the reason for that was that once he drills a hole in it, it's no longer a usable clay. And if it were Tamei, for example, it would lose its Tumah. The Tumah would disappear. Now, when he patches it, it's becoming a kli again, but the Jew owns it at that time. And if the Jew owns the kli, when it becomes a kli, it doesn't require tefillah in the mikvah. What's that? Yeah, but it's kind of hard to do with most, the more advanced the technology, it's kind of hard to do that. Oops, I just drilled through 50 transistors, but whatever. And even so, dipping in the mikvah might be a problem. It still damage the thing. So, generally speaking, there are different eitzes about it, but Rav Schechter has just said, he said, if you can't do tefillah, it's not a problem. It's a mitzvah saseh to do tefillah, and if you can't do it, you can't do it. Now, one major issue in the Rishonim is what is the status of this requirement of tefillah? Is this a din d'oraisa or a din d'rabbanan? There is a Rambam who, some claim the Rambam contradicts himself. I think if you read the Rambam very carefully, I think the Rambam assumes that all tefillahs kelim is only mid'rabbanan. There is a tshuva, the Rashba, that's quoted by the Beis Yosef, where the Rashba says, not everybody holds that tefillahs kelim midyan, that's what we call it, tefillahs kelim midyan, not everybody holds that that's the Rabbanan. It sounds like from the Rashba that many people did hold it was the Rabbanan. Everybody does agree that glass is only requires tefillah midrabbanan. However, you should be aware, there are many times there are signs posted. Don't pay any attention to the signs that are posted in the Kelim Miklas. Go ask someone who knows something, a shayla, because there have been many times I've seen errors on there. For example, there are signs that say you don't make a bracha on glass, and that is a ta'us gemura. It's true that the requirement of tefillah is chuches, of glass, is only midrabbanan, but it still requires tefillah. We make lots of brachas on things that are midrabbanan. It's explicit in Shulchan Aruch. There's no distinction between the bracha on metal and the bracha on glass. Nothing else requires tefillah. There's a homach locus about glazed china. How do you treat it? We're going to touch just only a little bit upon it in the Gemara when the kli is made of one thing and it's coated with something. Glazing may be already a separate question. There's also another very interesting question, what metals it applies to. The primary culprit being the question of aluminum, which is the Torah lists six metals. And if the Torah lists six metals, does that mean that it is only those six metals? In fact, there's only one other metal listed in Tanakh. The only one metal referred to in Tanakh. The six in the Torah are gold, silver, and copper, iron, tin, and lead. And in Nach, it's not mentioned in the Torah, there's a metal called Puch, antimony, which was used primarily, it was ground up into a powder, was used as an eyeshadow. So, though, but the only six metals are mentioned there, and there are achronim who say that the requirement of tevilas kelim, certainly, even if you hold it's midaraisa, for sure only applies to those six metals, doesn't apply to any other metal. Maybe midrabanan, based upon the same reason why we require glass to have tevila, maybe we would require all the metals to have tevila, but some would say that even if tevila of metals, daraisa, only of the six metals. Yes, Marshall.
Isn't brass or bronze mentioned by
Tubal Kain? Nechoshes and Barzel. Barzel is iron and Nechoshes is copper. Lotesh kol horesh Nechoshes uVarzel. So, why does it matter whether it's the rice or the rabbanon? We try to do all mitzvahs. So one of the areas that it comes up in is whether a katan would be neman. You want to send your kid to the kelim mikvah. So if you hold that it's a din daraisa, and there's a then the Shulchan Aruch suggests that a katan wouldn't have nemanus on tefillah. If it's by you talking about glass, then it would be a problem for the katan to do the tefillah. So, okay. One other very interesting issue about tefillas kelim, which is not discussed in the Gemara, but is spoken about in Tosfos. It's on the first few words of the Gemara. There is a very interesting halacha, which the Rabbanan did away with, I believe. How large does a mikveh have to be? So we assume a mikveh has to be 40 sa', which the Gemara says is 3 cubic amos. 1 amma by 1 amma by 3 amos tall, enough for a person to kind of fit in. I don't know how many liters, cubic, centimeters. You can do the calculation. It depends how big an amma is. Assume an amma is 21 inches or something like that, and you can do the math. Now, that is for tefilas adam. If you have a kli, a vessel that's tameh that needs to go to the mikvah for tuman tara purposes, so min ha-Torah, the Gemara says, you only need a revius. Now, most kelim couldn't fit into a revius, but let's say you have a little sewing needle and you want to make it tahar, so that could fit into a revius. If the rain makes a little puddle in the ground, you know, or you could, this morning you could go out and found probably many mikvahs of revius in the streets of New York City from the rainwater, so you could take, you could probably jewelry, you could be mitahar that way, you have a ring you want to be mitahar, minatori, you could stick it in that puddle, maybe you don't want to, but you could stick it in that puddle and it will be tahar. You know, that's like the same shayla about you going to the mikveh and then taking a shower afterwards. So, you know, you stick your thing in there, but now you want to wash it. But midrabanan, they were mevatel the din of revius by kelim. The question is, what is the din mid oraisa by tefilas klei midyan? Not for the tumah v'tahara purposes, but for making a food preparation vessel suitable for use. So Tosa says here, in Mayim Shehanida Tovelas, if you look at the third Tosfos, Tosa says, Afagav the Revius, Sagi Lahatpil Macha Temitzinorios Mida Oraisa, even though Revius is sufficient to immerse needles and little, you know, pins or tubes, Mida Oraisa, Hainu Tvilas Toma, Aval Tvilas Klemidyan Chidishu, Uboi Memsa. Tvilas Klemidyan is a Chidish. The Gemara is going to learn it from the words, Ach Bimei Nida Yishata, Mayim, Shehanida Toveles Bahem, and therefore it requires 40 saw. There is, I don't remember, I knew I should have looked this up, because I'm remembering what I forgot. 40 saw is only a requirement by a mikvah. If you have something that's a mayon, that is spring water, it's flowing uninterrupted out of the spring. So in a spring water, I'm pretty sure even for a person and for kelim, even midrabanan, you don't require 40 sa'. You only require the ability to immerse yourself completely under the water. There is a discussion about this, I think, in the context of tefilas kelim, this specific thing, but I don't remember what they say. I don't know if there are those rishonim who are machmir to say that tefilas klemidin always requires 40 sa'. I'm not sure. Okay, but anyway, Satosa says that this is a tefillah, this is a mega, this is a real tefillah. It's not enough to have a revius min ha-Torah. One actually requires 40 sa'.
The tefillas Ezra, the feather was misakim, you know, for somebody who is impure for one day. Does that impact anything?
No, that tefillah, that we will, God willing, since the vote has been for brachos, it may be a little time till we get there, but we will learn about the din of Tumas Tfilas Balkeri, which we don't observe anymore, but a person who has had a man who has had a seminal emission, or a man and a woman who had sex and there was ejaculation, both of them have the status of Balkeri, and in Medina de Gemara, they require tefillah before reciting Kriyashma, before davening, before learning, And
that philosophy is completely.
Well, yes, because there are three big kulas, the Gemara says in the third parak in Brachos, that the Olam, Nagu Almal Kahani Tlasavi, there were three minority opinions that Klal Yisrael adopted as their things. Only one of them is anything to do with the Masechta. That's Tvilas Balkeri, and they hold like Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, who says that Divrei Torah are not Mekablin Toma. Okay, the end. So anyway, Tzvilas Balkeri was in a mikveh, yeah. But they were makil for someone who was sick to pour, I think, Tisha Kavan?
Yeah, Tisha Kavan.
Which I know you have in a Torah also. Yes.
Today also.
So you have such a thing. Okay. Anyway, so we'll leave that to Brachos. Okay, so the Gemara says, Tana v'kulan srichan tvila b'arbaim sa. All of them, despite you have to kasher it the way the Mishnah said, require tvila and 40 sa. Now, if you looked at the Mishnah had three things. Darko lahat bil yatbil, lahagil yagil, lalabim bilor, yilabim bor. So what did the first one is tevila. So Rashi was sensitive to that, and he writes, Tana v'chulan, af hanigolim v'hamalubanim. In other words, the comment of the Braisa is only about the last two lines, not the first line in the Mishnah, because the first line in the Mishnah is talking about tevila. Something that only requires tevila, you just do tevila on. The other two things, either do hagali, do libun. So the Braisa, elaborating on the Mishnah, says, yes, but that means, but they still require tefillah also. Okay. What's that? Oh, I did, you're right. Let's go about, we'll finish it now, but we really have to talk about, when we get to the Gemara on that, we'll talk about what it means. Hashaput va'askala melabnon. A shaput is a spit, and askala is a grate, a grill, you know, that you put the meat on the fire. Milabnon par. They required libun. That makes sense. They're being used without a liquid medium between the kli and the meat. So if the goy used them, you require a libun. Hasakin, if you have a knife, shafa vihi ta'ora. Shafa means you sharpen it. You run it against the stone. Rashi says, lotsha be'evan shel napachim. Now, the question one has to ask about the knife in this case is, what are you allowed to do with this knife once you
grind it?
In other words, is this complete kashering, as some Rishonim will say, or some Rishonim say, no, it's only, the Gemara has a comment about only working for cold, for, you want to use it to cut cold things. Well, we're not going to get to it today. We'll talk about it when we get there, what that's about. Okay, thank you, Josh. So Tana v'kulan srichan tvila barbaim saw everything in the Mishnah, even the last, the two, numbers two and numbers three, that don't mention tvila, you require both hagola and tvila, or libun and tvila. Why? The reason is obvious, because the purpose of tvila is not to kasher a kli. Because you do it even when it's a new kli. I mean, the Mishnah presumably is talking about halokeach kli tash Mishnah, everything you buy, and let's say it was used. But it could be even that it's new. A new kli requires as well, and the Gemara will make that point. So, minahani mili, how do you know that there's a requirement of vilas kelim? Amar rava da amar kor, kol davar she'evo va'esh tavir va'esh vitoher. Hosif lecha hakosuv tahara acheres. The Torah says, tavir va'esh, it should have said, Kol davar sheva va'esh, tavir va'esh, v'chol ashele va'esh, tavir va'mayim. That it says. And it adds in between, ach b'meini da'is chatal. That's fine, because that's whatever that requirement is. But it says, tavir va'esh v'taher. So the pshat reading of the pasuk is, you shall pass it through the fire, v'taher, and it will thereby become pure. But since the Torah doesn't use that word at the end of the pasuk, now we would have said the pshat is the word is distributive. Ibn Ezra likes to say this: Moshe hu ve'acher imo. The word distributes a word, a preposition can be on the first word, but it draws the second word with it as well. So here you could say the v'taher distributes across both. It's understood v'chol ashalei avav aish tavir v'mayim v'taher. But instead, because it doesn't say v'taher by the second one, and we could do without it in theory, so the Gemara says, tavir v'esh, number one, and number two, v'taher. There's another thing that's required, and that is tvilas kelim. The interesting question that's discussed in the Rishonim here is the order question. And it's, can you do tvila
first,
before you do hagala or libun? There are Rishonim who say that it's no good. That to do tefillah on a kli before hagal and libun is like tovel v'sheretz biyado. It's like going to the mikveh when you're still holding on to the sheretz. That is a minority opinion. The majority opinion says really me'ikar hadin, the tefillah is good even though you do it beforehand. And the logic is almost incontrovertible. if you want to use, certainly Midin Torah, and even Midrabanan if you're doing it not on a regular basis, if you want to use a vessel that you buy from a non-Jew with cold things, let's say he used it on the fire, but you're going to use this pot with cold things, you're not going to cook anything in it, you don't have to do Libon or Hagala on it. Because Bitzonein, it doesn't emit anything. But you still have to do Tvila there. So let's say I want to do Tvila because I want to use the Kli cold. So I do the Tvila, I use the Kli cold. Now I decide, you know what? I want to use the hot stuff. So I do Hagala Liban. So you're going to tell me now I have to go do Tvila in the Mikveh afterwards? Again, that doesn't make any sense. So Me'ikar then we paskin that even though you did the Tvila first, it's good. But the Chatchila, you're supposed to wait to do the Tvila until after you kasher. Adrian?
Mm-hmm. I think you said before that the tefillah is only a mitzvah. You're not allowed to use it. Is that right?
No. So we would say we would say ordinarily if you can do the mitzvah, then you're not supposed to use it until you do the tefillah, because by using it, then you're being mevatel the mitzvah saseh. Now, if you don't plan on using it, there's no mitzvah. But if you want to use it, so then there's a mitzvah saseh. If you can't do the mitzvah saseh, it's impossible because you'll damage the kli, so you're potter. But if you can do the mitzvah, so then you're not supposed to use the kelim until you have done tefillah on them. What a student of mine asked me very recently, he had a shaylis in his shul. I forget what the kelim were, but it was hard. They hadn't been put in the mikveh yet, and it was hard to get them there because he's the rabbi. But the kelim mikveh hours were such that he and his wife were both working during the day, so they couldn't get there. So there is an eitzah that's used that should only be on a temporary basis. You're not allowed to do tefillah on Shabbos or on Yom Tov. It's a din derabanan. It's like fixing a kli. It's tikkun mana, but only on a derabanan level, right? Fixing a kli to be a Torah prohibition means you have to fix the kli. You have to hammer something in. You have to reshape it. You have to fix it. But here, it's only a metaphysical fixing. But we say you're not allowed to do it. So let's say Shabbos and Yom Tov come, and you need to use the kli. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I have guests coming. It's Yom Tov. How am I going to cook? So the answer is it's hard to do this in Tinek. It's probably much easier on the east side, which is you find your neighbor, the non-Jewish neighbor, and you're machna the kli to him. You will, if he's willing, he takes possession and ownership of the kli on a temporary basis. And because it belongs to a non-Jew, there's no mitzvah to the tefillah, and therefore you can use the kli in the interim until you have the chance to get it to the mikvah. So we have figured out eitzes. I believe that there are those who say, although I think this is a ridiculous approach, that when you have kelim that you can't be tovel because of electronic things, machna to a guy. I don't like that eitzes. That's meant to be a very temporary thing, and that's an emergency measure, you know, doing a harama, sneak effect to get around it.
Legal fiction.
Yeah, but no, we assume that until a kli has been used, you're not allowed to use it. Okay. All right. So now the Gemara continues from here. Tani bar kapara mitoch shenemar b'meinida. The Torah says meinida shomea ani shetzara chazar shlishi ushvi. You might think that all kelim that you buy from a guy require sprinkling on the third and the seventh day. So Talmud Lomar, ach chilek. No, you don't necessarily require it. In other words, if the kelim are not tmei meis, then there's no requirement to do tvila on them. So then, if that's the case, im kein ma Talmud Lomar b'mei nida, you would think, if mei nida means the sprinkling water is the paraduma, you would think every kli needs it. So he says, no. Mayim shenida tovelas bahem. Heve omer arba'im sov. In other words, meinida, which is Torah says, is always required. Ach b'meinida ischata. So meinida means two things. One thing it means is mehazah, the sprinkling, the waters of the paraduma. But that's ach. You don't necessarily require that. In fact, you may never, ever require it if you don't care about tumah v'tahara. But the Torah does say, b'meinida ischata. The answer is that's not meinida, the sprinkling waters. That's meinida, the waters that a nida goes, that anybody, but since the nida is the pasuk used in the Torah, a nida is tovel espahem. And that happens to be Arba'in Sa'ah. Okay, fine. So that's where the Gemara learns the idea of Tfilas Kalim from. Okay.
Arba'in Sa'ah. What's the basis of the 40
Sa'ah? Mayim shekol gufo shel Adam ola bahem v'shiru chachamim is Arba'in Sa'ah.
The whole body can go.
Yes. It is the subject. I always like to tell that the biggest troublemaker in the Beis Medrash was Rabbi Yirmiyah. He got thrown out of the Beis Medrash. He always was interested in the liminal points, the lines. So the Gemara Baba Basra talks about if you find a chick, a fledgling, near a chicken. Can fledglings fly yet? Or that's a hatchling. Whatever it is that can't fly yet. and you find it near a chicken, near a coop, near the dove cote, near the place it came from, if it's within 50 amos, you assume that it belongs to that one, if there's no other one closer. But if it's beyond 50 amos, you assume it didn't come from there, because these hatchlings never move more than 50 amos, more 50 amos away. Sir Virmia asks, what if it's got 1 foot in the 50 amos and 1 foot outside of the 50 amos? And the Gemara says, V'alda apkua l'Rav Yirmiyah mibei midrasha. They threw him out of the base medrash for that. So I forgot how the Gemara does say somewhere how he got back in. But it is fascinating that someone asked Rav Yirmiyah a question about, I don't know if it was about the mikvah case, it's a Gemara Rosh Hashanah, and he was the one, he had learned this lesson, and he responded and said, Kol shi'urin shel chachamim kachim. That's the way shi'urim work. B'arboim sa'hu tovel, b'arboim sa'chaser kurtav, Eino Tovel, etc. Right? So Rav Yirmiyah learned. That's the nature of Shirim. Shirim have to be established. I guess you could still ask the one leg in, one leg out question. I've always assumed chronologically the Gemara Rosh Hashanah was the grown up Rav Yirmiyah, but I suppose even if you respect Shirim or Shirim, but still 50 Amos, what if you're halfway in, halfway out? But that is the nature. They would kovea that a typical person, 40 saw would be the volume, you know, of a thing that you would fill with water that a person could immerse in. And it doesn't matter. Look, I could scrunch myself up. And the Rishonim talk about this. If I scrunch myself up, I could go much less. In fact, a mayon, the spring, where you don't require 40 saw, that's the way you go in a mayon. You kind of, you know, as I said, if you make a mold of me and you put a bathtub in a mold of me, you won't need that much water to cover me. Right? Because there's no wasted water. But still we say, our volume size this year. Okay. Fine. So the Gemara now says, v'itzrich l'michtav b'meinida, v'itzrich l'michtav b'meinida, ikse v'tahir havamina v'tahir koldahu. I would have thought any amount of water would be sufficient, maybe as long as it was a revius, so Rashi says a mikvah chaser. So that's why the Torah has to say, Kasa Rachmana b'meinida, mayim shenida tovelasmem. V'i kasa Rachmana b'meinida, havamina harv shemesh kenida. You would say that, yeah, it's tevila like a nida, and you have to wait till sundown in order to use it. And therefore, the Torah says, kasa Rachmana b'tahir la'altar. So I'll just conclude by just explaining that one din. When I was first learning on my own, it puzzled me greatly. A woman goes to the mikvah at night. She goes home to her husband, and then they can cohabit. And I never understood, because when you go to the mikveh normally, you have to wait for sunset. You have to wait for Harav Shemesh. If I am a Kohen, and I became Tameh, and I want to eat Truma, I go to the mikveh, and I wait for the next sundown, and that's when I'm allowed, sundown, say Sechom, that's when I'm allowed to eat. If I go to the mikveh at 10:30 at night, that's very nice, but I have to wait till tomorrow to go by sunset. So the question is, when a woman goes to the mikveh, why don't they have to wait till the following sunset? We obviously know you don't. So the Gemara actually explains why. There is one thing, food which you're not allowed to eat when you're tamei, but if you go to the mikveh, you can eat immediately when you're called a tful yom or a tful las yom for a woman. You mean you've gone to the mikveh, but you haven't had harif shemesh, you haven't had the sunset, and that food is maser sheni. If you have a person who's tamei, when they go to the mikveh and they're waiting just for sundown, they can eat maser sheni already. When the sundown comes, they can eat truma, and if it's someone who has to bring a karban, you know, like a woman who gave birth, a zav, a zava, then they have to wait to bring the karban until they can eat kachim. It's a three-stage process. First, you go to the mikveh, you can eat maser sheni, and then you go to Harav Shemesh, you can eat truma, and then you bring your karban, and you can eat kachim. So the Gemara says that nida labayla is kechulin. A woman who's a nida with respect to her husband is the same status of chulin or maser sheni, which just requires tefillin and mikveh. We don't observe tum of atar anymore today, but let's say in the context of nida, a woman who's a nida goes to the mikveh, she is muteris labayla as soon as she goes to the mikveh. But if we were concerned, if we were eating truma, let's say a woman who was married to a kohen, so she could immediately cohabit with her husband. Of course, they'd both be balikarian then, so they have to go to the mikveh again anyway to eat truma. But let's say she didn't cohabit with her husband. She would have to wait till the next Harav Shemesh in order to eat Truma. So the two issues are really separable. That's the way it is classically formed. There is another way, probably the real way of explaining it, and that's the metaphor the Gemara uses. Probably the real way of explaining it is that the Hilchos Nida, there are two parashias in the Torah of Nida which are totally disconnected. One of them is Isser V'Heter, the parasha of Arayas, and the other one is in the parasha of Tum Avatara. The parasha of Tum Avatara is at the end of Parshas Metzora, and there the Torah talks about Metzora, then Zav, Zava, Nida, and so on. All the Tumas associated with. There's no mention of a prohibition of cohabiting. And in fact, a zav and a mitzora, there really is no, certainly a zav, probably not a mitzora, it depends on his opinion, there's no prohibition of cohabitation. Then you get the parshas achrimos, then you get the iser of nida. So they're two separate parshas. So the purpose of tvila, the purpose of tvila for nida is to remove the iser of heter status. It also happens to accomplish something with Tumah Tara, but they're two totally separate arenas, and one requires tvila plus harav shemesh, and one only requires tvila. And that's why anida is muteris labayla miyatz. Anyway, the Gemara here says that you would have thought that if it were literally, if there were no v'taher, b'mei nida yischata, like Tumah v'tara, you would have thought that you require harav shemesh. That's why the Torah says v'taher, you are tara immediately, but you require 40 sa, mei nida, but it's v'taher, and you don't require harav shemesh. Okay, we'll stop with this. We have a little more next week to do in Tvilas Kelim, but